Erev Tov, everybody. On behalf of Torah Motion and for those in Israel, enjoy the snow. We've been enjoying the snow for a couple of weeks already, and I think we're going to have a lot more than you're going to get, even if you have a big storm, but enjoy it. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Rav Avram for part three of our four-part series. Today's topic is on manna from heaven. Bevakasha, Rav Avram.
Okay, thank you very much once again for inviting me to speak. And thank all of the participants who have tuned in. It's an honor for me to join this very worthwhile and informative program of Torah knowledge and the spread of Torah knowledge, and I'm honored to participate. Having said that, let's focus on Mun. Mun is the manna, the special bread that God bestowed on the children of Israel for the 40 years or so that they sojourned in the desert. It was one of three special gifts that God blessed our people with. The mun was the food source. The anani akavod were the clouds of glory that protected the people from the elements, the harsh elements of the desert. And the be'er of Miriam, which was the well water, which provided us with drinking water, which is, of course, very crucial to life. All three of these gifts were what enabled us to survive under those terribly harsh environmental conditions in the desert. But what's amazing is that although water is more crucial to life than food, of course, both are crucial to life ultimately, but the Torah plays up the mun and gives more, let's call it textual coverage to the mun that it does of the other two miracles. In fact, the Anani HaKavod are really submerged in the Torah. It's indicative through the Midrashic interpretations and the commentaries. It's not really expressly set forth in the Torah. And the Be'er Miriam is also not expressly set forth in the Torah, although there is a reference to Moshe Rabbeinu producing water, at least on two occasions, from rock. And we understand that this nace that of providing water sustained the children of Israel. But the mun gets a lot of play in the Torah. In fact, there are four references to the mun in the Torah. One is in Parshas Beshalach, which we read 2 weeks ago. The second is in Chukas. The third is in Bahaloscha, or first Bahaloscha before Chukas. And then in Akev. So there are four references to the Torah, in the Torah to the mun. So this leads us to the question of why is the mun more unique than the other two miracles that gave the children of Israel sustenance in the desert? Before we explore that question, there isn't even something more unique about the mun. And that you can see in source number one, where I'll read it in Hebrew and translate it by Yomer Hashem al Moshe, and God says to Moshe, Hinini mamtir lechem lechem in Hashemayim, I will cause to basically rain down from heaven bread, by v'yetze ha'om v'loktu, d'var yom b'yomo, let the nation, the people go out and collect it, gather it in day by day, l'mana nasenu, so that I may test them, Hayelech b'torasi imlo. Will they, the people, collectively as a nation, walk in the ways of my law, of my Torah, or not? Okay. In Sefer Devarim, it says again, and that's source number two. V'zuchartes kol haderech asher holichacha Hashem Elokecha, and recall and remember the entire journey that God led you, took you through. Zehar Boim Shana for 40 years by Midbar in the desert. Lamana noscha, in order to afflict you. Lenasoscha, to test you. Ladases Hashem Bilbavecha, to know that which is in your heart. Hasishmor mitzvosayim lo. Will you, the people, observe and guard my mitzvahs or not? There's another source, which is the secondary source in source number two. And that's from Devarim chapter 8, verse 15. And there it says, Hamavchilcha mon min ha-midbar, God who gave you food or gave you to eat man in the desert, asher lo yodun avosecha, which your ancestors knew naught of, lamana noscha, again, in order to afflict you, ulamana sosecha, in order to test you, lehetivcha ba'achrisecha, to bestow benefit upon you at the end. So we see that on these sources, the Torah keeps referring to man as A, an affliction, and B, as a test. What is the affliction and what is the test of the man? So Rashi, which is cited in verse number 3, by the way, there's a machlokus which we will explore among the commentaries to the Chumash, to the Torah, as to what is exactly the answer to those questions that we posed. What is the test and what is the affliction? So let's take Rashi first. You might say the premier commentary on the Chumash, although that's debatable, but we won't get into that. We'll follow the standard yeshivish approach that Rashi is the chief meforish of the Chumash. I think it's a misnomer to say that Rashi is the parshan, the one who gives pshat into the Torah. When it comes to halachic issues in the Torah, the recordation of the mitzvos and exposition of the mitzvos, Rashi is full of pshat. But when it comes to other aspects of the Torah, of the written law, Rashi is extremely midrashic. And we will encounter here a criticism of Rashi by the Ramban. And you will see how the Ramban speaks ever so strongly against what Rashi suggests. So let's first take a look at what Rashi says. And Rashi is in Shemos, in Shemot, Perek Tes Zayin, again, chapter 15, Pasuk Dalet, the fourth sentence. And Rashi is commenting on Laman Anasenu, where the Torah says that the man is in order to test you, the people. Hayelech b'Torah, see, will you walk in my Torah? Will you walk in my law? Will you follow my law? Rashi says, im yishru mitzvos atluyos ba. What is the test of the man? To see if the children of Israel will observe the commandments that are dependent or connected to the man. Shelo yivatiru mimenu, they will not deviate from these mitzvahs, velo yetsu b'shabbos lilkot. And they will, shelo yosiru mimenu, they will not leave over any of the man, because if you leave it over to the next day, it dries up, it forms worms, it's inedible. So therefore, the Torah, God said, go out, pick the man, pick a measure for each person. Every day you must pick it, you cannot leave it over, and you cannot go out and collect it on Shabbos. So Rashi says the test of the man is, will the children of Israel try to leave it over against the command of not leaving it over? And will they go out on the Sabbath day in order to collect the man, because they're used to going out every day to pick the man? So will they go out on Shabbos, notwithstanding the fact that God said, do not go out on Shabbos to collect the man? The problem with Rashi's approach is, how is this a test for 40 years? How many times can you leave over the man and the next day find it's wormy and spoiled? One time, two times, 10 times? You're going to tell me that for 40 years people were testing the man and that they were trying to see if it would last more than one day? I mean, it's not rational. Or it's not really reasonable to assume that the mun would be a test for 40 years. Can you leave it over? The second part of Rashi's commentary, that you will not, that the children, the test is that the children of Israel should not go out to collect the mun on Shabbos, on the Sabbath day. How many times on Shabbat can they go out to collect the mun? 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 5 weeks. And if they keep doing it, there's something wrong with them besides not listening to the Torah. Because you cannot go out more than a few times to see if the man will fall on the Sabbath day, only to discover that it is not falling on the Sabbath day. And certainly you're not going to go out on the Sabbath day for 40 years looking for man when you already know from past history that the man just does not fall on the Sabbath. So Rashi's pshat, Rashi's explanation of what is the test of the man, and then the Torah's depiction of this test to be for 40 years, doesn't really jive with reality. And the Ramban pounces on that, and that's in source number 4. Commenting again on that very text from the Torah, Lamana nasenu hayelef b'torasi, in order to test the people, will they follow in my laws? So first, the Ramban starts off by quoting Rashi. Im yishru mitzvah satulos bo, will the people observe the mitzvahs that are dependent or connected to the man? Shelo yosiru mimenu, they should not leave over, v'lo yetzu b'shabbos lilkot. Lashon Rashi, ve'eino nachon, this is not correct, says the Ramban. Why is it not correct? Obviously, I think the Ramban is alluding to the questions that we posed against the pshat of Rashi, and the Ramban therefore rejects Rashi's pshat. Aval hu kamosha omar, it's because of what I'm about to tell you, what the Torah recites from the Torah. Hamachilcho mon bamidbar asher lo yoduna vasecha, that God gave us to eat mon in the desert, in of which your ancestors knew naught, knew nothing. Lamana noska, in order to afflict you, ulamana sosecha, and in order to test you. Lehetivcha ba'achrisecha, to do good to you in your end. So the Ramban introduces what we already reviewed. There's two aspects to the mon. Rashi is quoting Hayel Anasenu, the test. Rashi's quoting his commentary flows from the words, Laman anasenu, in order that I test you. Hayelech b'torasi, will you go in my Torah? The Ramban introduces us to the pasuk in Bamidbar, where it then says, Hamachil chomon Bamidbar, Laman anoscha, in order to afflict you, which Rashi doesn't comment on altogether. And Laman nasosecha, and in order to test you. What is this, says the Ramban? Kinisayon hu lahem. Where the test was that there was not in their hand food. The Gemara uses the language of pas v'salo, bread in the basket. When you have pas v'salo, when you have your food readily available, and you can store it in your bread basket, you know it's there. You don't have anxiety. Where am I going to get food from tomorrow? Is it going to fall from heaven or is it not going to fall from heaven? Okay, so that the Ramban understands is what's the affliction? The affliction of the mon is the anxiety it creates because it only fell enough for one day. And every day, einecha tuluyos hashamayma, your eyes had to be focused on heaven. Was it going to come again? V'lo yiru lahem etza b'minbar rak hamon. There was no other solution. There was no other food source in the desert except for the man. Shelo yadu mitchila. They didn't know about this when they marched into the desert behind Moshe Rabbeinu leading them into the desert. But what Yirmiyahu Hanavi says, Zacharti lo chesed nuorayach avas kelu losayach. God recalls the kindness, the chesed of Am Yisrael, that they trusted in him and just walked blindly, so to speak, into the harsh conditions of the desert with not enough provisions to last more than, who knows, a few days or whatever it was. V'lo shamu miyavosam, they never heard of this man. It's not a tradition. It was not a tradition. They were not promised, they were promised redemption, but they were not promised at all there would be manna to supply them with food. V'yored lehem davar yom biyomo, and the measure would fall every single day. In other words, they could not stockpile it or hoard it. Biyomo, in its day, biyarivenu elav, and then they would starve for it. They would go out to get it because they had nothing else to eat. V'im kol zeh shomu lalechus acharai, and even with notwithstanding this anxiety and this angst that they did not have a steady a supply of food handily, readily available. But they listened to Hashem, to walk acharei Hashem, to walk after God. Lo makom lechem, into a place where there was no bread. V'kocha amar lehem, Zacharti is kol haderecha shehulichcha Hashem Elokecha. Ze 40 shana b'midbar l'mana nosecha l'mana sosecha. And that's what the Torah says in response to Rashi's, the question we asked on Rashi. How can this possibly be a test or an affliction for 40 years? You know, and Rashi's saying what it was, the test, whether they would observe, do not leave over and do not collect it on Shabbos. And so the Ramban says, no, that's not right. But here is the test. What? Hasishmor mitzvasai Eloki hoya yochol laholichom baderech ha'orim asher svivoseyem vaholichom b'midbar nachash sarof v'akrav. God didn't take him through, you know, the well-traveled portion of the land. I don't know exactly what the Ramban means. I don't know if there were cities in those in the desert that they could have gone through. But be that as it may, he took them into a wilderness where they were exposed to serpents and snakes and scorpions. B'shelo yilehem lechem rak min hashamayim devar yom biyomo. There was only food to them every day from heaven. L'naso sam, to test them. Lehitiv lehem ba'achrona, ultimately to provide for their sustenance, which was good. Shi'aminu bo la'olam, they should have trust and faith in Hashem forever. So the Ramban is telling us that what is the affliction? The affliction was the angst that the mon created by not falling more than one day's amount at a time. And the test was, would they have faith enough to follow after God into this hostile environment? Well, this also is problematic. What's problematic about the Ramban? First of all, the generation that went into the Midbar, okay, they were in the Midbar for 40 years. Remember, the Torah is telling us that this was a test and an affliction for 40 years. What about the young children who came into the desert, you know, before they were really astute and knowledgeable, before they were really sophisticated and understanding? They came to eat the mon day in, day out. If they were born in the desert, they knew nothing but the mon. That's the only source of food they had. You know, do people stop and say, whoa, what? I am really aggravated, or I have angst and anxiety. Am I going to be able to take my next breath? Am I going to breathe tomorrow? Does anybody, maybe great pious tzaddikim do that, but, you know, generally none of us are really, unless chas v'shalom, we have some illness, or we anticipate having some illness, which is, a form of mania, probably. We don't sit there and worry about where we're going to draw our next breath. We take it for granted that we're going to breathe. We take it, so to speak, many times for granted we're going to live. So now let's put ourselves into the situation. You're born in the desert. All you know is every day you get mon that rains down from heaven, and that's what you eat. Do you sit there and ponder, oh my goodness, back in Egypt, you know, before we were exposed to these scorpions and snakes, which, by the way, the clouds of glory protected them from, we are going to be worried, and we're going to have 40 years or 20 years or 10 years of any years of anxiety. What is this food? Where are we getting food from? No. After a while, you begin to take it for granted, just like all of the other miracles of life. Unless we are very astute and profound, we begin to take them for granted. So where, according to the Ramban, is there a 40-year test? How can we think that there's a 40-year test with the mon? Well, as a result, maybe of that question and maybe others, the Or HaChaim, which is cited in source number 5, has a different take on what is the test of the mon. So let's read the Or HaChaim. The Or HaChaim says in Shemos, again, Perek Tes Zayin, Pasuk Dalet, chapter 15, verse 4, Laman anasenu, ki lechem min hashamayim lo yitzarech shum tikun, bread that rains down from heaven needs no fixing. It was ready to be eaten as is. Certainly you didn't have to plow, and you didn't have to seed, and you didn't have to water, and you didn't have to harvest, and you didn't have to worry about pestilence, and you didn't have to worry about the climate and all these things that are involved in the production of food. Ubaze yu panuyim, he called, that would leave them with free time. They did not have to struggle and work and toil. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat bread, said God to Adam. No, there was no toiling. There was no really no worry about food. He agrees with our criticism of the Ramban. There's no anxiety about the food. They knew they came to take it for granted. But what is the test of the month? What do you do with your free time? He leaves off the end of the pasuk. I will see, God speaking, whether they will observe my Torah, whether they walk in the, what will they do at their free time? Will they, what's happening here now with everybody being quarantined, they tune into Netflix. What are they going to do with their free time? That's what was the test of the mon in the Midbar. It freed them up from all the toil associated with harvesting and producing food. And therefore, says the Or HaChaim, that is the test of the mon. By the way, note the Or HaChaim does not address what is the affliction. He only addresses what the test is. Just like Rashi, he does not go into the test of what is the affliction. The Ramban did address what the affliction was. He said it was the anxiety, but the Or HaChaim doesn't speak to that point. What remains troublesome with the Or HaChaim's pshat is, with the Or HaChaim's approach is, that the test is a byproduct of the mon. The mon itself is not the test. The emphasis is not how does the mon provide a test? It's what did the Israelites do with their free time? The mon merely provided each person with more free time. It itself, by its very essence, did not pose any test, leman anasenu, in order to test the people. The mon was not the source of the test. The free time is the source of the test. What will they do? Will they be productive in their free time? Will they spiritually employ their free time? That is the test of the mon, but that's not really apropos because it's not the mon itself that provides the test. Furthermore, the well that accompanied the Israelites and the clouds of glory also saved much time. If you have clouds of glory, you don't have to worry about the elements. You don't have to build very fortified structures. And even though they built Sukkot and they did live in huts, the huts could be, threadbare. The huts could be very unstable or not even very sturdy because they had Anani HaKavod who protected them from the elements and from the creatures and the creepy crawlers and all of those things. Therefore, even if they built Sukkot, they did not have to be formidable structures. And of course, the well provided them with water. They didn't have to go scrounging around and digging with tuning forks or whatever it was they were going to use to try to discover a source of water. So the mon is no better than the other two things that provided free time. So why does the Torah go out of its way to say that the mon is the source of their affliction and the source of their test? And that poses a very strong question on the Or HaChaim's approach. So I would like to offer another approach, another suggestion of what is the affliction and the test of the mon. Okay. I think the answer to the question is something we cited above, but let's take a little closer look at it, and it's in source number 6. Bahasaf sufa sherbikir bo, and the rabble that was amongst them, hisavu tava, they were overcome with a great lust, a great desire. Vayashuvu vayifku, and they began to cry and complain. And the Bnei Yisrael, and they led or encouraged or instigated that the children of Israel join them, not only with a rabble swept up in this emotion, but they said, "Mi yachilenu basar? Who's going to give us meat? You know, we're eating this mon. What about a good pastrami sandwich, a good corned beef sandwich? Where's the meat? As the advertisement said, where's the beef?" Okay, what they said, we want meat. Zocharnu es hadagah, we remember the fish. asher nochal b'Mitzrayim, that we ate in Egypt, chinam, for nothing. We didn't have to pay for it. Our masters provided it to us. Es ha-kishuim, es ha-valetichim, es ha-chatzir, es ha-bitzolim. We remember the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic, all these things. V'ata nafshenu yivesha. And now our souls are parched, are dried up. Ein kol, there's nothing to eat. Bilti el hamon einenu, except this mon which is before our eyes. What are they complaining about here? Especially if you consider the midrashic approach that the mon tasted like whatever they desired. That's a very problematic medrash, because the Torah tells us it was sapichas bidvash, it had a taste of honey, etc. And therefore, the medrash is elaborating, and I don't want to get into that because I'm a rationalist and follow the pshat most of the time. But let's even assume that the medrash is right, that they did have an extensive ability to taste whatever they liked when they ate the mon, magical bread from heaven. What were they tired of? Presentation. Ein kol bilti el hamon einenu. What is before our eyes? Day in, day out, all the same. The same, the same, the same. We don't have any variety. Chefs will tell you that presentation is just as important as the recipe of the food that is prepared. And if any of you, watch these chef shows on television, you will see that they spend just as much time arranging everything on the plate with colors, with flowers, with streaks along the side of the plate, and they make the presentation a piece of art, mamish. And that's because presentation influences the Epicurean appetite. And it makes you feel that the food is even more delicious than it really is or it actually is, because presentation is a great measure and a great part of succulent eating. Ha! Comes along the people and they say, Mamon is not artistically presented. It falls from heaven. It lies on the ground. Who knows if it gets a few pebbles of dirt in it, whatever it is. You pick it up and you eat it. There's no variety. There's no presentation. We get tired of eating the same thing or even looking at the same thing, even if we again assume that it tasted differently if we wanted it to. But it didn't change in appearance. Its presentation was the same. Day in, day out, 40 years, it's just we get tired of it. And take a look in source number 7. Bamidbar Perek Chaf Aleph, and that's in Bamidbar, Numbers, chapter 21. Did I speak about Shemot here? Yeah, I did. Okay, we talked about the advantage, or we thought was a seeming advantage to the Gentile interpretation of the book of Shemot. We called it Shemot, they called it Exodus. And of course, we discussed why Shemot is so apropos and so very, very crucial to understanding the nature of our relationship as a nation to Hashem. That's what we spoke about. But for sure, in Numbers, we go way beyond them. They talk about the fourth book of the Chumash as being Numbers. It's sort of an innocuous, meaningless name compared to Bamidbar, which captures the thrust of the 40-year sojourn in the desert and the unfolding and unraveling of the mission that took place in the desert. Anyway, if you take a look in Bamidbar, chapter 21, Vayedaber ha'om be'elokim, the people complained against God or spoke about God, ube Moshe, and against Moshe, lomo helisunim b'Mitzrayim, lomus Bamidbar. Why did you take us up from Egypt to die here in the desert? Ki ein lechem be'ein mayim, there's no bread and there's no water, v'nafshenu kotza, v'lechem ha'klokel. And our lives are disgusted by the insubstantial bread. What was insubstantial about the mon? Say the Mefarshim, it produced no waste. It had no body, no tangible body. It was like a wafer, very light. It had no weight. And we got disgusted by it. You couldn't sink your teeth into a succulent steak if you ate mon. Maybe it tasted like steak, maybe it didn't, but it certainly wasn't succulent and you couldn't, you know, sink your teeth into it, as like I just said a moment ago. So notwithstanding this quality of the mon, that it was lechem haklokel, it did not cause waste. There was no acid reflux. There was no, upset stomachs. There was no, God forbid, diarrhea. None of these things that afflict us from our diet, which, of course, when we eat inappropriate foods and we suffer the consequences, there were no consequences, no suffering consequences to the mon. It created no bodily waste. It appeared punctually every day. No one suffered by eating from it. It was a godly staple designed to perfectly fuel and replenish the body. So not mon tested the purpose of eating. Why is there human consumption? Do we eat to be healthy, to be sound, to be well, to be strong, to be healthy in a sense, or do we eat to satisfy our gluttonous appetite? Do we eat because we savor that hamburger, or do we eat to fortify our body, give it strength so that we can continue to serve Hashem, to worship Him in ways, and to be totally available without fail, without suffering any consequences of poor eating habits? So those people who grew to detest the mon, they failed in this basic test of life. What is our purpose in this world? And what is the purpose of consumption? What is the purpose of beautifying our homes? What is the purpose of having a beautiful car or an expensive car or clothing or food, anything that we have that we partake of this world? Do we do it to serve our own egos? Do we do it to serve our own purposes, our own gluttony? Or do we eat or consume these objects and these products in order to fortify our belief and trust in Hashem and make ourselves available to serve His purposes, which is the study of Torah, the performance of mitzvahs, acts of kindness, acts of charity, acts of compassion? That's the purpose of life. And that was the test of the month. Why do we eat? And therefore, it was a test of 40 years. And it was, in a sense, an affliction to those who had this, what we would call feinschmecker palate, and they needed to have the succulent steak. So to them, it was an affliction. And to others, it was a test of what is the purpose of consumption. The godly bread of angels was the perfect food, unless you had another agenda in the reason for consumption. Okay, but let us now talk about the problems that the mon created. Was it all good, or did it create social problems for the people of Israel? Let's examine what happens when you have bread or food falling from heaven, raining down from heaven daily. Well, you lose your initiative. You don't have to work. You don't have to do anything. You sit back and relax, and the food comes. If not, well, you know, the Medrash says it depends on what type of a person you were. If you were very righteous, it came to your doorstep. If you were less righteous, it came, I don't know, 20 feet away. And if less and less, until maybe you had to walk a mile for it. I don't know if you were wicked. Doubt if a mile, you know, somewhere within the camp of Israel, you would have to walk to get the mon. So there was a minor aspect of initiative, that is just going out and gathering it in. But there was no initiative of toiling in the fields and working and laboring and sweating over it, etc. So when you end up having free food served to you on a silver platter, so to speak, you lose your ambition. There's nothing to do. There's nothing to work for. There's nothing to strive for. Loss of initiative. That's one social problem of the mon. Another social problem of the mon, as you lose the value of days. When there's no need to labor and no urgency to work, there's no need to schedule and order one's day. what are you going to do? I'm going to get up in the morning. I'm going to take out the tractor. I'm going to go into the field. I'm going to wait. I'm going to weed today. I'm going to seed tomorrow. I'm going to do all kinds of things. There's nothing. The day just whiles away with nothing for you to do. You lose appreciation for the day, for each day. You also, a third problem is you lose a sense of daily time. There's no reason to get up at 9 o'clock or 6 o'clock or whatever time you get up. I can get up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, unfortunately, we have this situation of like children at risk who, you know, they drop out of school, whether it be Jewish, Hebrew schools, secular schools, whatever it is, they drop out. What do? They stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning. They get up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and their whole day is skewered because they don't have any appreciation for time. Time is meaningless to them. And that's another problem that the mon could create. If you have nothing to accomplish, you can end up wasting away time and dislocating your time, disconnecting from productive time. Time becomes meaningless. The final social challenge of the mon is you lose a sense of value. You know, if you get it every day, okay, you begin to take it for granted, but you don't appreciate it. You appreciate what you struggle for. You appreciate what you toil and work for. You don't appreciate things that are given to you, you know, on a silver platter day in, day out. You lose respect for the object. The same thing is true of a person who receives benefit from someone every single day. Ultimately, they begin to resent the person. If you're so dependent on somebody, you begin to find fault in that dependency and you turn on the person who is so kind to you and good to you because you can't take the fact that you are dependent on that person. The same thing happened with the mon. It could happen with the mon. You begin to lose appreciation for the product because it's there all the time for you. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, is sensitive to these issues. And hence the Torah addresses these four problems, these four social problems in the Parsha of the Mon, which is in the Parsha of B'Shalach. Now, before we get into an analysis of the text to reveal how the Torah addressed each of these social problems, I will introduce you to a booklet. If you can see it here, I don't know if you can see it. It's a book that is called Studying the Torah, subtitle, A Guide to the In-Depth Interpretation. It's written by Rabbi Dr. Avigdor Banchek, Zichrono Livracha. He was another student from Ne'er Israel. He was older than me, although I did, when I came to the yeshiva that very year, he left. But we found some of his term papers and other documents that he left behind for guys to, benefit from. We'll not talk about how, but he left them behind. And ultimately, I met up with him in Baltimore because he returned for a stint where he was an educational consultant to the CJE, which was the Center for Jewish Education in Baltimore. And he was a scholar and a Talmud Chacham and a sociologist. Sociologist. Anyway, he wrote a number of Sfarim. Amongst them, he wrote this book that I'm showing to you. What is remarkable about this book is that it has in it 14 keys to deciphering text in the Tanakh. He has 14 keys, which he suggests every serious student of Tanakh should study and know what they are. The eighth, what he calls key to studying, the in-depth studying of Tanakh, he describes this as the seven code. He calls it the seven code. Now, if you're familiar with Parshanim in the Gush and other places, modern Parshanim, many, many of them embrace the seven code without attribution to where this idea originated from. What Rabbi Banchik tells us is that in 1788, a small booklet was published in Italy called Mafteach Hayam, the key to the sea of the Torah. This author of this pamphlet was a blind scholar, totally blind, who was very perceptive and especially attuned as a result of his personal challenge to nuance in the language of the Torah text. He made a novel discovery, which was picked up, as I said before, by subsequent biblical scholars, and is set forth in some fascinating detail in Rabbi Bonchik's Sefer, which I introduced to you before. By the way, Rabbi Bonchik died about a year or two ago here, and I was, I wouldn't say privileged, but I had the zechus of going to be Menachem Abel, his almana, and he was a very exceptional person. He helped many, many, not just the secular Jews, but yeshiva students who he was able to counsel and guide, and he was a remarkable person. Anyway, this discovery basically is predicated upon being specially attentive to language in the Torah. And language in the Torah, in many, many situations, you will find once you know about this code, the seven code, this key, the seven code, you will begin to search out and find repetitive words in the Torah in multiples of seven or near seven. You will see soon in the Parsha of the Mon, there are four seven codes. Each one of those seven codes addresses a social ill that we talked about in the Mon. And let's get to work. So take a look in source number 8. Now it's a long source because this is the entire basic Parsha of the Mon. Okay. And you will see what I did here, it's certainly in the Hebrew text and in the English text, which follows, the translation follows immediately thereafter. I highlighted for you by emboldening it in black or darker print the key words that are repetitive that flesh out the seven codes that are buried in this parsha. The first word is baboker. And you will see if you count that Baboker actually appears 8 times. One time it's double. Let's see where that is. Baboker, Baboker. Anybody want to find it for me here? Let me just see. Let's see. Okay. Hold on one second. Okay. One time it says it, if you trace, I can't locate it right off the top of my head, but it's here. Baboker, Baboker. It's 8 times. So we know why, what is the 8 times? It's one beyond the seven code. So what is the Torah telling us by stressing Baboker? It's saying, if you don't get up in the morning, Bechama Shemesh V'Nomes, the sun will warm up and the mun will melt. There's no sleeping to 2 o'clock in the afternoon if you want to get mun. Mun requires early rising to protect against the social ill of having food available readily every day to prevent people from sleeping and whiling away the day. It says Baboker 8 times. One time Baboker, Baboker. We know from the dream of Paro. What does Yosef say when Paro, Val Hishanos HaChalom El Paro, and because God repeated the dream to Paro, because he's Mamaher LaSoSo, he's going to bring it about quickly. So Baboker means get up quickly in the morning, because if you don't get up quickly, it will melt and dissipate and disappear, and you will have nothing to eat. So that's the first ill that it addresses. The second, thing that comes up is Yom. 7 times it says Yom in this parsha. Why does it say 7 times Yom? Because it's to highlight, A, again, 3 times in one pasuk, to highlight the rapid passage of a day. You know, if you're going to get up and be non-productive and idle away the day in indolence, not even one day can you afford to frittle away, because if you fritter away one day, you will not have what to eat. The mona appeared every day, and again, it addresses the social issue of not being productive during your daytime. Push off something of importance, of value for the next day or for some other time in the future, it sullies the matter and the of consequence and belittles the importance of what you need to address and attend to. So the Torah tells us again in the Parsha of Mon, Yom, 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 seven times, to impress upon us that we need to be careful and not waste away the day. Then the Torah tells us seven times, Laket, Vayilokat, pick and choose and gather in the Mon, meaning you need to have initiative. It will not come to the table. It will not just, you know, you can't open your refrigerator and find the mon. You're going to have to do something to go out and collect it. Okay, if you're a tzaddik, you have to do less. But no matter how righteous and great you are, you must do something to produce the mon. You cannot allow the mon to make you, you know, non-productive. And again, it addresses the ill, the social ill of losing initiative, losing any oomph, any desire to do anything. The mon requires some effort, even if it's minimal. And for those who were not righteous, it wasn't just so minimal. It still required effort. And that's what the Torah is telling us in this seven code that you, that stresses leket, that you need to go and collect the mon. And the fourth thing that the mon that is stressed in the Parsha is Omer. But if you count the appearance of Omer in this Parsha, you will see that it appears only six times and not seven times. And the reason for that is because it didn't fall on Shabbat. So it fell six times a week. Six times a week you could gather, you can go out and gather the mon. On Shabbos it didn't fall, so there's no mention of Omer a seventh time. But what is it telling us? If you leave it over, it spoils. If you try to take too much, Omer laugil golas, there was only, you could only collect enough for each head meaning for each person. And if you went and took too much, it spoiled. If you left it over, it spoiled. If you tried to find it on Shabbos, it wasn't there. That's what the Torah is telling us in that sixth code, or really it's a seventh code, but the reason it's not there seven times is I explained. So it also fits into the pattern of the seventh time. So again, if you count in this Parsha, which I highlighted for you in bolded type, both in English and in Hebrew, you will see that all of the social issues of the mon are addressed in the Torah text to teach us that even when God is gracious and beneficent and grants you things easily in life, do not take it for granted and understand that you need to appreciate what you're getting. You know, Yeshlo Mono wrote the Masayim, the pursuit of materialism is so ensnaring and so addictive in a sense that once you achieve a little, you want more, and you get more, you want even more than more. And so it is you know, you're on a treadmill. You're on this addictive treadmill of pursuing materialism. I'm not talking to Rabbi Jay, and I'm not talking to all of the others who are pious and righteous and know what that's right in life and have put value on what is really important in life. I'm talking about our general society. I'm talking about our Orthodox general society. The pursuit, I mean, all you have to do is open up a Orthodox magazine. Look in Ami, look in Mishpacha, look in the newspapers, the holy newspapers, and you will see advertisements, full-page advertisements, this celebration, that celebrated, this opportunity, that suit, this dress, all the materialism of the world is focused on the Orthodox community. I find it nauseating, frankly, but that's what's passé. That's what's acceptable in our society. The mon is the antithesis of this. The mon is to teach us the opposite. The pursuit of materialism is self-destructive. And that was the test and the affliction of the Mon to those who think that aggregating materialism is the end all of life. And they really compartmentalize their lives, their pursuit of orthodoxy and Torah values. Yes, they'll give an hour a day, 2 hours a day, maybe even more. But their pursuit of materialism, 7, 8, 10, 12 hours a day. And that becomes the primary drive of life, which is the antithesis of the mind. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
In Pasuk Chav Aleph, the Pasuk says, Vayilketu oto baboker baboker ishkefi ochlo.
Ah, that's a good thing. It's missing in the text. Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, I think that.
It's good to have a scholar on board who can fish out.
For some reason, it's missing in your source sheet. I don't know why, where you copied it from.
You should look where
that Chumash comes from. If that was a mistake when you I assume that's a mistake in the Chumash you copied from.
That's a mistake in the Bar Ilan, because I lifted this straight out of the Bar Ilan.
Right. So it's clearly a mistake in Bar Ilan, because I looked it up too. When I see in the Chumash, I also remember Boker. I'm looking. I don't see it.
So
I picked up the Chumash. I said, where is it?
I'm looking at my source sheet and it's not there. I said,
Correct. It's not on the source sheet. So you better tell Bar Ilan.
I'm happy both you and Rabbi Finkelstein pointed this out to me. I'm happy because it's not a mistake. It's there twice. It's to indicate the urgency of getting up early in the morning. Just like by Paro, it was to impress the urgency of what Yosef said, the interpretation of the dream here too. It's to impress upon us the urgency of not getting up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
It does appear in the English translation.
Oh, good.
That you have.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I don't know if you want to address the first question. Maybe it's way beyond the topic about the relationship between Rashi and Halakha, I guess. You said when it comes to...
What do you mean, Rashi? And Rashi having the reputation of being shot in the Chumash?
The question is, are we supposed to learn halakha from Rashi's Torah commentary? I mean, I think it's a broader issue.
So it's no different than learning halakha from the Talmud. Yeah, the Rashi tries to explain to us how the halakha is embedded in the text of the Torah, and it's a worthwhile task, and many times it's right on the mark. But every so often, there's things there that are not exactly in accordance with the halakha, and you have to understand that the halakha was a formative process, and Rashi wasn't the final say in the halacha, and the halacha that's transcendent down to us, we can start maybe with the Rambam and the Rosh and the Shulchan Aruch, but even beyond that, it goes in now to the Mishnah Brura, the Shmira Shabbos Kihochasa. There's all kinds of halachic works, some of them, more Haredi, and some of them more Machmir, some of them less Machmir. You might say the Orach HaShulchan is less Machmir. The Mishnah Brura is more Machmir. And I once heard from my Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, he said that if, of blessed memory, if you would ask a scholar, which work is more scholarly, the Orach HaShulchan or the Mishnah Brura?
Well, no, the Orach HaShulchan. There's no question. Everybody's going to agree with what Rabbi Weinberg said, I think, but I'll let you.
The Orach HaShulchan is much more scholarly. First 100%. Of all, he starts all the way from the original source. He develops the halacha through the Rishonim down through Achronim. He develops the halacha to the bottom line, as we would say. The Mishnah Brura is all over the place. If you read his parish, he jumps from one opinion to another opinion and back. The Orach HaShulchan was much more scholarly, much more orderly. The question is, how come the Mishnah Brura had the zechus to grab the Torah world and dominate? Rav Weinberg said it was because of the tzikus of the Chafetz Chaim. His piety, HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewarded him because of his great piety and his humility. For years, the Chafetz Chaim peddled his Mishnah Brura anonymously. And if you open up the fly sheet or the opening to the Mishnah Brura, it doesn't identify the author, at least in the original text. It did not even identify the author. He went about the world selling the Mishnah Berurah from town to town anonymously. In fact, is that's how he met Rav Kook. He came to the home of Rav Kook's father-in-law, the Aderet, and there is where Rav Kook met the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim came to Ponevich, where Aderet was the Rav Mora D'Asra, and he went to the Mora D'Asra to show him the Mishnah Berurah and convince him that it was a worthwhile text. He, of course, had to sell it. He had an enormous expense in printing it. He had to peddle it around Europe, in the Torah world in Europe. And that's how he met Rav Kook in the home of the Aderis, where Rav Kook was, as they say in Yiddish, eating kest. You know what eating kest meant? His father-in-law was holding him out, supporting him, while he was learning all day. And there he met the Chafetz Chaim. And they had an enduring relationship throughout the Chafetz Chaim's life. Rav Kook was in contact with the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim is the one that encouraged Rav Kook to leave the, so to speak, Kollel, and to join the rabbinate and become a Rav, a Mora HaRav of Yisrael. Anyway, that's what the Zechus said Rav Weinberg of the Chafetz Chaim. His humility and his piety.
Right, so he didn't read Chaim Soloveitchik's article, which is Rupture and Reconstruction. I'm not that where Chaim Soloveitchik, of course, explains that that's the, if you remember this classic article that everybody has to read, Rupture and Reconstruction, and Tradition last year did sort of a review of it 25 years later, where he said that's the transmission from a mimetic text to a text, a mimetic tradition to a text tradition. And because of the Holocaust and this desire to be more strict and everything, we recreated a Judaism, you know, Judaism as it should have been, but never was. And basically everything went back to text. The Aruch HaShulchan was a lover of the mimetic tradition as well. You came back from yeshiva and you told your mother in Hilchot Shabbos, you can't eat this fish, borer, and your mother told you to jump in the lake. I don't care what you learn in yeshiva.
Yes, it was Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg.
Right. I'm sorry?
Rabbi Usher Stein asked me if what I said Rav Weinberg was I referring to Rav Yaakov Weinberg. Yeah. The answer is yes.
Yeah. So you anyway, know that we switched
I'm not gonna argue with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who's
both are true, by the way. It doesn't have to be they contradict each other. Right. Obviously one's writing fast. You can't prove the piety thing. That's a little bit harder. And of course,
because the Mishnah Berurah already took root in pre war Europe.
I can tell you Rav Schechter told us, being in his year. I'm talking about the 1980s. Rav Schechter told us that Rav Soloveitchik never quoted the Mishnah Berurah. His father-in-law never quoted the Mishnah Berurah. I believe his father-in-law, for sure, Rav Soloveitchik. The tradition that Mishnah Berurah was not in their canon of Svarim.
That's right. My father-in-law, Rabbi Avram Kelman, of blessed memory, did not own a Mishnah Berurah.
So Rav Schechter told us his wife bought him in, I guess, 68 or 69 as a birthday present. The set of Mishnah Berurah. He had never seen a Mishnah Berurah in his life. And, you know, he knows like Kol HaTorah Kula. And he read it. And he told us when his wife was giving birth, you know, I guess the men didn't go into the delivery room. So he was in the hospital. So he took a sefer with him. So he took the Mishnah Berurah with him. And he told us he read the Mishnah Berurah and his hair stood on edge. On every single page, the Mishnah Berurah changes the halacha, the san halacha. And it's, you know, Rav Schechter's style of speaking, a reform rabbi. The Mishnah Berurah is like a reform rabbi. And every page, the Shulchan Aruch says, A, the practice is, and he quotes the Eliyahu Rabbah, and this one, and that one, and this one, Afena and Her, the Machmir changes. So, and lo and behold, in one generation, the Mishnah Berurah. So a lot of it is, I think, has to do with where he came from. It has to do with the chumras and everything we're looking for. And I'll add one thing.
It has to do with the general trend of Judaism.
Correct. The general trend to move.
Bought my father-in-law the Mishnah Berurah. He never, until I married my wife, my father-in-law, who was a Rav and a Paskin for his Kehillah, never had a Mishnah Berurah until I bought him one.
Okay, that's cool.
Little story to Rav Schechter.
Okay,
I bought my
Mishnah Berurah.
He never quoted it. He didn't look in it. Basically, he looked in the Aruch HaShulchan or he looked in the writings of Rav Price, and he was able to paskin from the Shulchan Aruch, the Aruch HaShulchan, and that was it. He didn't have a Mishnah Berurah. He never referenced it or referred to it.
And of course, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and I hear many others told their, Rav Schechter told us it, that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said, The Balabatim shouldn't use the Mishnah Berurah. For Balabatim, we pass him from the Arach HaShulchan. Guys in yeshiva, they want to be machmer, fine, they can use the Mishnah Berurah.
Okay.
But it was never meant for the Hamonam. But I don't know if he would say that nowadays. I'm quoting things I remember him saying in Shir
right.
years and years ago.
The world has moved
different
so
world
far
today.
To the right. You know what I say, Rabbi Jay? The world has moved so far to the right, it's lucky that the Chazal adopted that it's round. Because if it was flat, they would have fallen off a long time ago. They keep moving to the right until they would have fallen off.
I'll just add one other thing, which I don't remember. I don't want to quote because if I misquoted, I don't want to quote in his name. I think I know who said it. And I think there's more than one person said it. There is a problem when a tzaddik writes a halachic work. You don't want the tzaddik hador writing a halachic work. You want somebody, quote unquote, normal, who understands that people are, you know,
I don't want to get that critical of the Chafetz Chaim.
Right.
That
I understand. Normal. I don't mean it like
I don't
that.
I want to say he wasn't normal. I
right.
want to say and on his level, on his level, it's roy to be machmir. On his level, it's roy to adopt all these stringencies. And I'll tell you a funny story if you want to hear a funny story. In Eretz Yisrael, there was a young man. I mean, he's now he's older than me, about 3 or 4 years older than me. Ultimately, he was my night seder chavrusa. His name was Rabbi Simcha. His name is Rabbi Simcha Soloveitchik. He is a son of the Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was a rav in Muncie, of Spring Valley. Okay. And his wife, this Rebbetzin Soloveitchik, started the Beis Yaakov there. He was a big rabbi in Muncie, Spring Valley area. And he was, of course, from the Soloveitchik family, a great grandson of the Beis HaLevi. Anyway, the Rab Simcha Soloveitchik got married during my stay in the yeshiva. And of course, we were all invited to the chasana. At the chasana, of course, there was Mishalto, Misamda, you know, the aristocracy of the yeshivish type world. And Rav Chaim Zimmerman was invited of blessed memory to the chasana. Well, he came east from Chicago, where he was a Rosh Yeshiva. And, of course, he enthralled all of the Elta Bachram of the yeshiva who were at the wedding. And a big crowd formed around Rav Chaim Zimmerman, listening as he was pontificating. As he was talking, along passed Rabbi Kaplan, the founder of the Beis Yaakov in Williamsburg. What was his first name? Baruch, I don't remember. But anyway, he passes by and he hears Rabbi Zimmerman pontificating. So he was very, you know, pious and you know, a mussernik. He goes over with his hands like this, and he says to Reb Chaim Zimmerman, he spoke to him in Yiddish, he says, Aduch sich mir as the Reb Chaim Efsheret avak loshen hara. I'm afraid, he says, that I hear what you're saying, and it could be like the dust of loshen hara. Not mamish loshen hara, but on the fringe, on the periphery of loshen hara. So Rav Chaim says to him, he didn't know who he was, apparently. He says, Icher Rav Yid Icher. I hear what you're saying. And he keeps going. And this rabbi stands there and he's listening some more. And all of a sudden he says, Rav Chaim, Efshir et the Rebbe Mamish Lashon Hara. Now you may be speaking Mamish Lashon Hara. So he says to him, Icher Rav Yid Icher. I'm here. I hear what you're saying. And he keeps going. Finally, he says to Rav Chaim, "The Mishnah, the Chofetz Chaim zogt as das is da 36 lavim of miede of eine vos red loshen hara." He says to Rav Chaim Zimmerman, "The Chofetz Chaim says there are 36 lavim to somebody who speaks loshen hara. You should stop." Rav Chaim says to him, "The Rambam steht nur zwei." In the Rambam, there only is listed 2 lavim, not 36 lavim. The Rambam only says 2, not 36. So he says to Rav Chaim, the Chofetz Chaim given a gadol ador. He says, the Chofetz Chaim was a gadol ador. How can you disagree with the Chofetz Chaim? So Rav Chaim says to him, in the Rambam, in nit given a gadol ador. He says, the Rambam wasn't a gadol ador. The Rambam was also a gadol ador. And he says, there's only 2. And everybody cracked up, of course, at that point. But that was like the point that you were making before, that the Chofetz Chaim was a super pietist, and he could derive and determine and extricate and extract various prohibitions all surrounding Lashon Hara, which may not necessarily be halachic alpi the emes halacha. Anyway, so much for that.
This is fascinating. How which posek gets in and trends change. You know, the one generation to another. You know, the pendulum now is very much to the right. They'll swing to the left.
Well, are you familiar with the work of Rabbi Elezer Malame, the Pnimei Halacha?
So he today is the most, probably the biggest posek in the world. I understand his books have sold over 1 million copies. He is the I got about 11 or 12 volumes. I'm sure since then there have been more.
Yeah, no, there's like 18 or so volumes now. Anyway, I mentioned Rav Melamed. Well, number one, I have a chavrusa and I study Rav Melamed Svarim about an hour and a half every day. You know, kol hashana halachas b'chol yom muftach lo shu ben olam haba. I want to know a little bit more of halacha, which I did not really invest too much time in during my yeshiva stay. So now that I'm, old and a retiree, I have time to learn halacha, and I focus on the Pnimei Halacha. I've covered about 7 or 8 of his volumes already. But be that as it may, Rav Melamed is a maker. And almost on every shaila, he brings all of the shittas, or he'll bring the opposing views, and then he'll call lamaisa. Bottom line, what's the halacha? Kedivrei ha-maker. Because we have a cloud.
Throughout history, the great poskim were always mechilim.
The Gemara goes already back and says koach dehetera adif. But besides that, 90% of what we're engaged in is rabbinic, and the halacha is kamekol bedivrei chachamim. Anytime you're involved with a derabbanon, you go lekula. And Rav Melamed makes that point almost on every page, certainly on every issue. And he follows the Mekel. He tells you if you want to be, exemplary, you can be Machmir, but know that the bottom line halacha is Kedivrei HaMekel.
This will have a great influence. I'm not in Israel, but I know. I know how
popular. I'll tell you that, though, in the Haredi world, he's unknown.
I will also tell you, even in the Chardal world now, there has been an attempt, this is for off the record, there have been an attack, he's been attacked very much recently because he's in favor of the reform having a prayer service at the Kotel, a place
right,
that
right, right, right,
and he's
right,
also right. in favor of the conversion.
That's right, the new Kahana. Conversion laws.
So he believes that, and he, of course, recently had a very talk with a leading reform rabbi in France, and he said it was a very much eye-opening to him. To see that, the Reform Jews, and they got attacked, and he buckled down on it.
He has what we call in Yiddish breite pleitze. You know what breite pleitze means?
No, broad, but I can figure it out.
Broad shoulders. He's not afraid. It's amazing.
Right. No great poskim are afraid. That's what makes them great. Rav Moshe was the same way. Rav Moshe was also pretty much a mekel and had broad shoulders, and he got attacked, and he didn't back down.
In Yonei Shabbos, he was not a mekel, but he was a mekel in many other areas.
Yeah, in many areas. And not correct. Not in but right. So listen.
And Rav Moshe got attacked. He got attacked on his artificial insemination.
Right, that was the big one. He got attacked on.
He was attacked very viciously by very
by Satmar.
The Satmar burnt his sperm. And I think that at one point they tried to attack him. That's interesting. So who pointed that out? That Rav Aaron Felder of blessed memory, who was a posek in his own right, and a son of a posek, and a Talmud Muvok of Rav Moshe Feinstein, said that what is the title that you give to a rabbi? It's Heter Hora'a. Heter Hora'a. Right. To be Mater. And that's an interesting point.
He's quoting his father, Gedalia Felder, Mordechai, right. From Toronto, of course, right? His father, who, of course, we knew well, very well. And the son, I didn't know so well. But, Rev.
He left one son in Toronto, Yaakov. But who's
I know. I know him quite well, sure. Yeah, the rabbi. He's the rabbi. He took over his father's shul. He's a different type of posek from his father. Let's leave it at that.
He's more of a right winger, but Aaron.
Yeah, very much. Correct. Aaron, his brother, who was in Philly.
He was more in line with his father's writings.
Yeah, there's a lot to discuss about the halacha.
Okay. Yeah, anyway, be well, everybody.
Yeah, be well. I thank you for the people who stayed overtime. I always find this the most interesting part. I mean, you know, everything's interesting, but this is the Rabbi most fun part. Okay, Rabbi thanks, Rabbi Abram. We'll see you next week. Next week is on the Mishkan, I believe, right?
No, next week is on the sins of the desert.
Oh, the sins of the desert. I'm sorry. Okay, the sins of the desert. Okay, very good. And
I could switch the topic if you'd like.
No, it's fine. We can do another. No. I just, whatever, you know, I'm warming up for Parsha Truma, you know, and tonight, of course, Dr. Sokolow, tomorrow, Malka Simkowitz starts. We're going to have a triple header tomorrow. Malka Simkowitz, 10:30, the Jews of ancient Egypt. She's a scholar of this period of Judaism. 10:30, Shuli at 12, continuing her archaeology series. And tomorrow night, Rabbi Helfgott, Natty Helfgott from Teaneck, will be giving the Parsha Shir at 8:30, and then I'll giving my Shir at 9:00 on Friday morning. And Monday, okay, Sunday's Rabbi Liebtag, of course, and Monday, Mark Shapiro will restart. He'll be back with a series now on the rise of Reform Judaism. So that's more interesting stuff on this type of stuff that Mark loves and I love, and we talk about a lot. So development of halacha, et cetera, et cetera.
That's interesting. Okay, listen, once again, thank you for allowing me to share.
Our pleasure. Okay, we'll see you next week. Please, God, and thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Avram. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.